You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show, again, without Brian Callen. You know, Brian has sort of decided to take on a role in this podcast, not unlike the Holy Ghost. He was the Father, you know, guiding and shaping everything, but now he's just sort of more an ethereal spirit that floats around the podcast and occasionally comes down as tongues of fire on my head to divinely inspire the occasional joke. So I guess that makes me Jesus, although I'm pretty sure that Brian has marked out that role for himself as well. So the entire Holy Trinity is missing. Fortunately, in its place, we have on the line Professor Joseph Henrich, who is now at Harvard University, which is an okay school. And he has written a phenomenal book. You know, I was talking with him before he hopped on the line about how excited Brian and I are for The Big Ideas, any book that really introduces a whole new way of looking at the world. And that is what he has brought together in his new book, The Secret of Our Success, How Culture is Driving Human Evolution, Domesticating Our Species and Making Us Smarter. Professor Henrich, just to warm things up, why don't you tell us about how you won the anthropological research lottery?
You mean by developing a field research project in Fiji?
Yeah, as I was saying, like, you know, Papua New Guinea just seems like a terrible place. I mean, you know, cannibals, all sorts of nasty snakes and spiders, you know, very inaccessible, all sorts of ways you can die. And Fiji is kind of the ultimate tropical paradise, isn't it?
Well, I did shop around a little bit. So my first field site was in the Peruvian Amazon, mm-hmm. and I did about 6 months of research there. And then I moved on to rural southern Chile around the city of Temuco. And I spent a year wandering around there talking to farmers and small-scale agriculturalists, running economic experiments. And then when I got my first job, I thought I wanted to study the evolution of human societies, and so how humans went from relatively small-scale societies 12,000 years ago to big complex nation states. And one of the key transitions there is to hereditary chiefdoms. So Fiji still has hereditary chiefdoms at the island level where each village is governed by a hereditary chief. And I was also interested in how people made use of marine environments. So there'd been a lot of work on hunting and gathering and in tropical forests, but in Fiji, the villages are heavily dependent on the fishing and gathering stuff along the beach and whatnot. So that drew me to the South Pacific, and then I was looking for a place with no malaria. And so that led me to Fiji.
Well, that was all very erudite, and, you know, I would have just been like, white sandy beaches sound really nice. But you did some of that research, it seems like, from reading between the lines in the book, with your wife.
Yeah. Yeah, so we spent several months together there, and we actually had my daughter Zoe, who's now 11, but was 1.5 at the time.
Wow.
So she was running around the village.
Well, you know, congratulations. And I mean, even just to, you know, start to segue into the book, you know, one of the things that you found out in Fiji is that there were these very interesting taboos for pregnant women around eating certain kind of fish.
Right, right. That was one of those fun ethnographic experiences where I was sitting at a Fijian sit on the ground, Fijian style, with their legs crossed and these mats. And the meal was being served. And as I was eating, I noticed one of the women at the other end of the mat, the big turtle was being served. And she wasn't partaking of any of the turtle, which is a real delicacy. So I was curious as to why, and I found out that she was pregnant. So this led me to wonder, you know, it was explained that this was a taboo, and this led me to wonder about these taboos. So then my wife and I began an investigation from there.
Yeah, and so the taboo is basically that they don't eat a lot of the top predators, the moray eel, the shark, the barracuda, and the turtles, right? And that
right.
is because...
Well, what we did was we went and we tried to find out what all the taboos were. Mm-hmm. And then we began to notice a pattern in the taboos that they seemed to be against the fish that were most likely to contain Cinguatera toxin, which is a dangerous marine toxin that accumulates up the food chain and becomes most dangerous in your top predators, but also potentially in turtles. You find it in sharks, barracudas. And these were all tabooed for women who were pregnant and breastfeeding. And then a little investigation of the medical literature shows that this toxin can pass into breast milk and be passed on to infants. So the taboo makes good adaptive sense, but the people themselves don't seem to have a consistent kind of causal model. So it's an example of a cultural adaptation, something that evolved over generations, where the people themselves don't have a full causal understanding of how it works.
Right, and something like that wouldn't be genetic. That would be purely cultural.
Right, right. So the neat thing about the way humans learn from each other is that this unconscious process of selecting certain members of our social group, like the healthier and more successful, over generations can produce behavioral repertoires or bodies of knowledge that are well adapted to the environment without us really understanding how it got to be that way, and of course purely non-genetically.
And that's what's so fascinating in the book is there are so many of these examples again and again of cultures doing things that we, you know, are incredibly smart and we don't understand them at all at the time. And then we realize that they've maybe not with the right reasoning, but stumbled onto the right action, but without even understanding why they're doing it. So, I mean, for example, you know, manioc and cassava, a lot of those varieties are, you know, very, very toxic and have a lot of cyanide, right?
Right. So in South America, especially in remote areas where it's hard to plant any other crops, lots of populations have complex food processing procedure that they apply to cassava, and this allows them to extract the cyanide out of this a certain kind of cassava and reduce its level so it's completely safe to eat. But when the Portuguese transport cassava to Africa in the 17th century, they transported lots of this, it's called bitter manioc, that has the cyanide in it. And people began planting it because you could plant it in lots of places where it's hard to do other kinds of farming. But of course, they didn't transport the know-how and the cultural practices that allow you to get the cyanide out of it. So, and this kind of cassava, at least some varieties of it, can create chronic cyanide poisoning. So you can eat it, and it's a bit bitter, but it doesn't make you sick initially. But then over many years, you end up getting all kinds of problems, health problems, neurological problems from the accumulation of cyanide in your system.
Yeah, and especially when it's the cornerstone of your food supply.
Right, right. So it's a highly productive crop, so it can easily become your staple.
And I mean, when you're talking about this very complex processing, I mean, you have a diagram in the book that really sort of breaks it out. And I mean, we're talking, it's a day-long process, things steep, and then you extract them, and then you do this, you have to grind it up very finely. It really feels like something that Walter White would do on Breaking Bad. Like,
right.
It's incredibly elaborate organic chemistry.
Yeah, and the key is that if you weren't kind of faithfully following the cultural procedure, you might bail out early in the process and think that because if you tasted the cassava at a certain point, it's lost its bitter taste, and mm-hmm. you might think, well, now's a good time to do it, it's fine. But you still have some leftover cyanide there that could real cause you health problems. So you kind of got to stick to the procedure you've acquired from previous generations.
Yeah, and it's just amazing again and again how non-intuitive a lot of these procedures are. I mean, the other one that you really talk about in the book is corn processing, where, you know, they would put the corn together with ash because it turns out that corn actually has, you know, does have enough of, you know, niacin, this very particular B vitamin, but the only way to extract it is to mix it with some sort of alkali. So you find, you know, these Central American cultures would mix ash into their corn. But then again, when corn was transported to Europe, they didn't understand this procedure, right?
And so right. And so if you don't get enough niacin, you get a horrible disease called pellagra. So when corn is taken over to Europe, especially poor populations end up becoming dependent on corn because it was cheap and easy to grow in lots of places. So they would all get pellagra. And it took a long time for Europeans and Americans to figure out that it was actually this lack of this vitamin B niacin that was causing this horrible disease, pellagra. And I tell the story of Joseph Goldberger, who actually figures out, but the medical establishment won't accept what's actually the true causal model of what's happening, that it's actually the corn not having enough of this B vitamin that's causing the illness.
And so what this all leads up to is a pretty shocking conclusion for, you know, the children of the Enlightenment that we are, which is it turns out that superstitions are actually super useful.
Yeah, yeah, at least in some cases. So we shouldn't assume just because we see what seems to be a superstition or a taboo or some ancient practice that seems outdated or archaic. It might be, but it also might hold some wisdom or embody in it some traditional know-how that is not clearly understood by the users of the practice itself.
And this goes into, I mean, you know, your book really sort of fits within all of the stuff that's being done on Homo economicus, you know, Damasio's work on, you know, Descartes' error. It's all, and, you know, David Sloan Wilson's work on multi-level selection. It's this whole new view of humanity where we're understanding that we are not primarily rational creatures who sit around, evaluate the facts, and then make reasoned choices. That's, I mean, we have that capacity, but it's not our default state.
Right. And so the one of the key things in the book is that the secret of our success is that we can selectively learn from other members of our social group. That what we are is not good at figuring stuff out or innately intelligent, innately rational, but really we're good selective copiers, so that over generations this process can create all these kind of cool cultural adaptations that help us survive and spread into diverse environments and construct social institutions without the individuals themselves having an understanding of it. So we've been talking about kind of these food products and kind of technological adaptations, but it's also the case that we don't understand how our institutions work.
Mm-hmm.
So how marriage systems traditionally built alliances across groups, or how monogamous marriage suppresses competition amongst males within a society. So there's neat ways in which our social institutions manipulate our psychology.
Well, and I mean, to take that even further, I mean, most of us don't understand how the economy or democracy works.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know, the emergent intelligence, even without us necessarily understanding why we do the things that we do or what matters or what the functional parts are, through a process of collective experimentation, we can slowly but surely iterate our way towards some sort of positive solution.
Right. And that idea of collective experimentation or collective intelligence, what I call the collective brains that humans have, is created by the fact that we can share information and learn from each other over many generations. And it's that process that really generates a lot of the fancy innovations we see.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what we think of, you know, in the modern world, we tend to think of innovation as caused by scientific inquiry. But a lot of times the fancy innovations, things like the steam engine, actually drove our causal understanding of it. So first you get a steam engine that works, and then that gives you a window into the world of thermodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And helps you figure out the laws which actually underpin the steam engine. So the products of cumulative cultural evolution actually then drive our scientific and causal understandings of the stuff that underpins those technologies.
Right. And just from, you know, I mean, my background is in education, but I mean, you know, that's what you see often, right? People understand the analogy first and then extrapolate principles out from that.
Exactly.
And yeah, I mean, I think that I really was fascinated as well by some of the stuff in the beginning of the book, which is just sort of about, you know, human intelligence, right? You know, we think of ourselves as the smart ape. But when you actually give IQ tests to toddlers and compare them to chimpanzees or orangutans, what do you find?
Yeah, well, so the humans only really outperform the other apes in social learning tasks and imitation tasks. So batteries of cognitive tests that look at their ability to deal with quantities or their understandings of space, the 2.5-year-olds don't do much better than the other apes, are you know, just basically equal. Now, we know that over time, as those 2.5-year-olds get older, in the societies that they're growing up in, they're going to end up being much better at those tasks than adult apes are. But one of the key things is that humans keep getting better and better and better, and part of that is a cultural download of information. So in our society, for example, we learn an unbounded counting system, so all of us can keep counting up until we would get tired.
Mm-hmm.
But in lots of human societies, populations counted 1, 2, 3, many, and there was no easy way to distinguish 37 from 38. Or even 12 from 13. So, but when we acquire that, so that sort of gives us an advantage in all kinds of tasks because we have this numerical counting system. We also get, for example, basic color terms for all kinds of different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And this improves our ability to make distinctions between different kinds of colors.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think that's the interesting thing. Even, yeah, the fact that you had to choose toddlers, I mean, really tells you so much about the fact that we really are the cultural ape, and that is the great distinguisher. It's not the opposable thumb. It's not so much the ability to walk upright. Yes, all of these things may have been important, and it's not even necessarily that our brains are actually so big. It's the fact that we have the ability to transmit ideas. It's that we are wired to podcast.
one of our major achievements.
Exactly. But yeah, and so, you know, collectively, by sharing these ideas between each other, we can get an emergence intelligence even we don't even understand it. And one of the things that Brian and I were texting about, because I knew he would love this one in particular, is, you know, divining among the Naskapi. So could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Sure. So the Naskapi are an Aboriginal group in Canada, and like other populations, they have divination rituals. So when you decide where you want to go hunting, rather than just going where you've heard there are recently animals or to the last place you had good luck, you actually put some bones into a fire, and you wait for the bones to crack and break. And then you examine those bones in a way that tries to use them like a map. So you're looking for features and stuff that you can match the landscape. And then using that, you can then figure out where you want to hunt. And there's an underlying piece of game theory here where you're trying to match where the animals are going to be. But the animals are playing a different game where they're trying to mismatch you. They want to be where you're not. So if you go back to the place you've previously been, the animal's trying not to be in that place. So if the animal sees a human there, he's going to avoid that spot in the future. And if you hear a report about a location where an animal has been seen, those animals are going to try to avoid that place because they've seen humans there. So those are two bad places to go. Well, so what this divination strategy allows the hunter to do is to randomly go to a place. And that turns out to be the Nash equilibrium, the game theoretically optimal strategy that you should use. But humans are really bad randomizers. Chimps are actually pretty good randomizers compared to humans. And this throws our strategies off in lots of cases where you have to use a randomizing strategy. So divination is one way the humans that have culturally evolved to allow humans to randomize. And it's a neat case because you can imagine if the hunters actually knew that they weren't actually getting to see the future or getting to see where the animals are, that this was just a dice rolling game, that they might be more inclined to rely on their intuitions or expectations rather than relying on the dice roll. So in that sense, it's a case where it's probably better that people don't understand the what's actually going on beneath the surface.
Right. And so, again, what we're seeing is we see a practice that, you know, we would judge as stupid superstition, but in fact, it turns out to be Nobel Prize level work, right?
Right, right.
Because they understand what, you know, we're only really starting to understand, which is that, you know, how our cognitive biases shift us towards certain decisions, like going back to the same hunting grounds or whatever. And they figured out this clever workaround with the materials they have available, you know, caribou shoulder blades or whatever it may be, to basically randomize their own behavior.
Exactly. And one of the key things, the key kind of genetic evolutionary selection pressures that these kinds of cultural practices are going to create is that you've got to be faithful to these cumulative cultural practices because they're going to get you through and they've allowed humans to survive for a long period of time. So, I mean, I call this the origins of faith. It's why we are willing to, at the expense of our own intuitions and own experience, sometimes rely on the beliefs and practices that we acquire from previous generations.
Yeah, and one of the things that I loved in the book is you talked about the heuristic of essentially, like, if in doubt, copy everything.
Right.
Right. So could you talk us through that a little bit more? Because I always find that fascinating. You know, I mean, I tutor kids, I work with kids, and they always focus on the exact wrong parts of success. You know, they're like, I'm going to wear glasses, and therefore I will be smart. You know, or
you're
like,
right.
Or I'm going to have wild hair like Einstein, and that means I'm a genius. And these are obviously not the important parts of why Einstein succeeded or the kid in the front row is doing well in school.
Right. And the reason for that I lay out in the book is that sometimes we're forced to use these cues, very generalized cues for success or prestige.
Mm-hmm.
So prestige is specific in this case. So when we're using a prestige cue, we're looking at who other people are paying attention to and who they're listening to and imitating. And so as a learner, you're watching who other people are attending to, and then you're focusing your cultural learning in on them. But these more general cues don't tell you why that person got to be successful or why other people are paying attention to them. And so in the absence of any specific things to tell you what to pay attention to, you're going to copy many different things from that person. So if a young hunter is paying attention to the older, most successful hunter in the group, they might copy how they make their arrow and the fact that they leave early and their, the fact that they eat a lot of carrots. But they might also copy the fact that they say a prayer before they depart, a particular hat they wear, or some other stylistic thing that isn't causally connected to them becoming a great hunter. And it's hard to tell in the real world which things are causally connected to someone's success or prestige and which things aren't. So it causes these things to transmit in big bunches and explains why we're so inclined as humans to copy particularly successful actors or highly prestigious sports stars or something.
Right, because, I mean, and again, you know, it comes down to what do humans actually care about, mating success, right, overwhelmingly. And if you've got an actor or an athlete who's getting laid a lot, you're like, oh, I'm going to, like, copy their shoe line. I'm going to take the supplements they take. You know, I'm going to do the workout they do. I'm going to read the books they read, all of that sort of stuff.
Right, and because it's pretty hard to figure out, at least as a first-pass learner, which of those things actually leads to their success and, you know, this way others view them. So, and now as you go along, of course, you might sort out and you might realize that it's not actually their exercise routine, or maybe it is, or it's not actually the fact that they wear glasses. But at least as a first pass, you can start off by copying these bundles.
Yeah, you copy everything and then you whittle out, like, what are the things that actually work? Or you don't. You just copy everything and then you transmit everything to the next generation.
It can really spread. One of my favorite examples, recent examples, is the Angelina Jolie effect, where she wrote this op-ed in the New York Times, and this had in the op-ed, she describes her decision to get a double mastectomy after being diagnosed with a particular genetic variant that's known to be associated with breast cancer. And so this leads to a proliferation of women seeking this genetic test and seeking to get this operation throughout the English-speaking world. So in Canada, the U.S., England, Australia, and New Zealand, you find evidence of inflood of calls and then elevated rates of people seeking this operation.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think that's the thing is that recognizing that that's actually how people work, right? Celebrities suddenly have a very different role to play in society, right?
Right, an extremely important role because, lots of learners are going to be actively engaged in that. That comes across in this evidence of suicide. So when celebrities commit suicide, people not only will tend to copy them and there'll be a spike in suicide rates, but they'll actually copy method. And you can figure out who's most susceptible to copying suicide by knowing the age and the ethnicity of the celebrity, because people tend to use those as cues to figure out who they're going to learn from.
So I better hope that no Kennedys commit suicide because I look like a Kennedy. No, that's wishful thinking. But anyway, a lot of this actually reminded me of Everett Rogers' Diffusion of Innovations, which is one of my all-time favorite books. But, you know, one of the stories that he tells in there is of a healthcare worker who goes into this small Andean village and she's trying to get people to boil water. Right before
right.
they drink it. Very, very simple healthcare innovation. And she fails. And she fails because she tries to come in there and, like, rationally engage them and show them pictures of bacteria and whatever else and explain the process and all that sort of stuff. And, of course, the idea that there are these invisible creatures in your water that you can't see, but if you boil them and then let the water cool down, magically they are gone forever. Right? I mean,
right.
it sounds
right.
like a crazy, crazy superstition. And the problem is that she really focused on engaging the people who were receptive as opposed to going to the three coolest women in the village,
right.
getting them to boil water. And then if she gets them to boil water, then everybody else will copy them.
Yeah. And this really touches on a kind of central model that you find in lots of development and public health policy, where people think the key is education, that if you can just explain the underlying cause or the facts, this is going to cause people to change their behavior. And in example after example, this doesn't seem to work. And it's because people are not acquiring the causal understanding as the first move, that are often the causal model follows the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So first you get people to change their behavior, and then they find it easy to adopt your causal model after the fact.
Right, and you give the example in the book of James Cook.
Right, with the example of the sauerkraut.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So, the explorer, he was a lieutenant at the time, but people know him as Captain Cook. And he was trying to figure out how to prevent scurvy, which had plagued maritime expeditions for hundreds of years, going all the way back to the beginning, basically. And he got a bit of advice from an English physician that said he might want to try sauerkraut, that there had been some hints that this might help. So his challenge was figuring out how to get his sailors, who are, you know, had a very fixed and customary diet, they're real creatures of habit, to adopt this strange tasting food, sauerkraut, that they were unfamiliar with. So rather than ordering it, which would be, you know, a typical move by a sort of Navy commander, he decided to just have it dressed and served at the officer's mess, but not at the enlisted men's mess. And so what happened, which is shortly after the enlisted men saw him, saw the officers getting it, they started requesting some of the sauerkraut as rations. And soon, you know, there was just endless requests for the sauerkraut, and they had to put a hold so that you only had a certain serving. And this was the first time in an expedition of this length had gone the entire time with no cases of scurvy. So this basically ended scurvy, you know, as soon as this practice rapidly disseminated through the English Navy.
Yeah, and ironically, I mean, you know, Everett Rogers actually opens his book talking about scurvy as the archetypal example of a great innovation that did not diffuse.
Right.
Because, I mean, if scurvy had been a problem, as you said, for hundreds of years, and really, I mean, you know, evidence had mounted for hundreds and hundreds of years that the answer was citrus, sauerkraut, any food that contained vitamin C. But it was people like Cook who finally understood how you actually get the idea to move.
Right. And yeah, because there's this great case that Rogers talks about by Captain Lancaster. And he just by chance ends up with three ships sailing back from India, one of which gets loaded up with lemons. And so because they happen to have a lot of lemons on board, they start serving lemons to their crew. Meanwhile, the other two ships get massive amounts of scurvy as they're sailing back, and they end up, but the lemon ship gets no one who has scurvy on it. So they start restaffing the other ships with guys from the lemon ship. And, you know, that's just a nicely controlled experiment, which basically hits you in the face with what the answer is. But despite that, that practice doesn't spread, even though Lancaster made a report and, you know, the facts seem to be there. The facts didn't actually drive the change.
Right, exactly. And so, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this, you know, the secret of our success, your book is, I mean, it's a fascinating read and it's full of great anecdotes. But it's also deeply, deeply practical, right? I mean, like this whole new model, and, you know, once we really sort of embrace the fact that we are this cultural ape, and how that process of cultural innovation and cultural imitation works. I mean, there's a whole bunch of applications for education, for health, for, you know, how we really get innovations to actually diffuse.
Yeah, I mean, the broad intellectual goal here is to come up with a psychological and evolutionarily grounded understanding of how humans make decisions and what drives our behavior, rather than relying on what economics has relied on, which is this rational actor, this idea that really comes out of the dreams of Enlightenment philosophers.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the thing. I mean, even those Enlightenment philosophers, of course, were driven by that same process, right?
Right. And so is the diffusion of their ideas.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, a lot of it was based on prestige and copying and imitating, and, you know, I mean, they were all obsessed with the Greeks and the Romans, and, you know, they wanted to live the high status. Exactly, the LeBron Jameses of the of the 1700s.
Exactly.
In terms of going forward, I mean, the other thing that I think is fascinating that's also worth talking about, right, is that, you know, where this fits into intellectual history. I mean, you know, you and I have talked about how this is a real shift away from Homo economicus, right? But so, you know, we have all these different competing models of how human beings work, right? That humans are primarily rational actors, you know, that we are a blank slate and you can upload literally any culture. And then you have people like Pinker and Dawkins who react against that and who are essentially saying, no, it's primarily a genetic process. And now we're, you know, I mean, with you, you're sort of, you know, it's not a rejection, it's not a swing back of the pendulum, it's really a refining of that and a honing in on something that's more accurate.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, there's a real kind of sociological history of the ideas here, where when people first began to apply evolutionary thinking to human behavior, this was viewed in contrast to cultural explanations. But then the real revolution occurred, among a group of mathematical theorists, Mark Feldman, Luca Luigi Cavalli-Schwarz, Rob Boyd, Pete Richardson developed a set of mathematical models where they used the logic of natural selection to try to explain human learning, rather than saying learning is one side and natural selection acting on genes is the other side. So this helped us build a theory of human learning, which then gives rise to culture and cultural evolution. And then in my book, I try to argue, following this intellectual tradition, that that's really the central driving force driving human genetic evolution, is the products of this learning from each other that goes on over generations and generates things like we've talked about, like the putting of ash into your corn or the divination rituals and things like that. And that's quite a different picture than the original formulation, which is that there's this genetic evolution occurring and culture is just a reflection of that. And maybe there was some cultural evolution that happened later in human history, but it's not important for explaining the genetic evolutionary process.
Right. And to be clear, it's, this is really nature plus nurture, right? I mean, it's both because, just to give the due, right, the example of lactase tolerance, right? I mean, that's a good example. Would you mind talking us through that?
Sure. So one of the things I want to do in the book is convince people or provide the evidence that, in fact, culture is more than powerful enough to drive genetic evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the problems I'm interested in occurred deeper back in human evolutionary history. So things like learning how to cook shapes our stomachs and our teeth and our intestines, but that's now spanned all the way across the human species. So there's no way to take advantages of differences that exist in the human species now. But we can look at more recent events. So with the spread of cultural practices related to domestication and taking milk from animals, this actually created an opportunity for genetic evolution. So when groups got domesticated animals and began milking them, there's all this nutrition available in milk, but humans older than about age 5 lack the ability to break down the lactose sugars in milk. We use an enzyme called lactase to do that, which shuts down at around age 5 in non-human primates and in many humans today. But genetic changes in certain groups of Africans and certain groups of Europeans allowed that processing to continue. It sort of threw a monkey wrench in the typical mammalian off switch for that. So now adults in Europe and parts of Africa traditionally can break down the sugar into adulthood, and this releases a whole bounty of nutrition for those populations. So those genes are in the process of spreading through the human population, but it's far from complete, and about 66% of humans are still can't process the lactose and break it down. So it's very much an in-process selection pressure.
Yeah, and the minority of people can process milk, right, into adulthood.
Right.
And, I thought it was interesting as well what you were saying about, obviously the West got rich first and then proceeded to say, everyone should do what we're doing.
Right. So a failure to appreciate these kinds of processes led the U.S. government to have a program that began in the 1950s, which pushed and promoted fresh milk drinking for everyone. And this had a detrimental effect on lots of minority groups because those groups don't have the genes which allow them to continue to break down and process lactose. So if you drink a lot of fluid milk, you actually get sick. And so that has health consequences. So, it was something that seemed right for the children of European descent populations, but it's actually not good for everyone. But the assumption that it was, and this persisted for 40 years or something like that.
So the point is, milk does the body good if you happen to have a genetic background from Western Europe or
right.
certain parts of Africa.
Right, depending on your population history, exactly.
Slightly less catchy slogan.
Right. It should have been an asterisk, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Milk Marketing Board, there's a group that I want to piss off. what you're seeing is, I also love the example of amylase, right? Amylase is the enzyme that is in your saliva that breaks down starch. And it turns out that chimps generally have 2 copies of the amylase gene.
Right.
And then humans have somewhere between 5 and 7.
Yeah, and on average in different populations, but the human populations vary in terms of how many of these copies, and these are reduplications. So the more of these reduplications you have, the better you are at processing starch. Mm-hmm. So in populations that have been heavily dependent on starch processing for the core of their nutrition, they tend to have a lot of copies of these, and those that don't have fewer. So humans in general all are much better at, say, breaking down a potato than chimpanzees, but you can say something based on the population history and on the dietary choices of that group. And of course, and we know that these depend not on kind of pure ecology, but different groups in the same ecology will establish different economic systems and focus on different kinds of foods. So it really means the cultural norms that govern the economic and food norms then drive genetic evolution to affect your amylase reduplication number.
Right. And I mean, even for example, I mean, the it turns out that, again, one of those adaptive cultural evolutions is, that's not a real phrase, one of those real sort of adaptive cultural practices that we see is, you know, how spicy your food is, right?
Yeah. So that's a case where, In of course, lots of populations, for traditionally, before refrigeration and whatnot, meat was a real danger to have pathogens. And the longer you kept the meat around, the more danger it was. And this is particularly dangerous in hot climates. So if you look at the distribution of different spices, in hot climates, the traditional recipes and people's tastes are more in preferring spices like onions and garlic and oregano and allspice that are potent antimicrobials. So they kill the bacteria in meat, making the meat safer to eat. And that's most important in hot climates. And then as you go north, by the time you get to Norway, there are very few kind of antimicrobial spices used in food. And this explains at least part of the gradient, north-south gradient, we see in the sort of spiciness of foods. So this was a big insight by the detailed study of spices and their chemical effects on bacteria. And of course, this is all going on unconsciously, so people don't decide they're going to eat spicy food because they're worried about bacteria. But my explanation, and the explanation of the authors of this original work, Paul Sherman and Jennifer Billings, argue that it's people learning from healthier, more successful families over time gradually spreads these recipes that lead people to have better health.
Right. So it's very much the LeBron James effect, right? You are like, oh, look at the Patels. They do really, really well. Let's all eat extra spicy food.
Right. But of course, in this case, LeBron James's haircut might spread and it might not actually be what makes him good. But it's,
right.
They're getting the good stuff in this case.
Right. Exactly. But I mean, that again, like we see the adaptive power of just copying everything.
Right. It wasn't, nobody rationally figured out that spicing is a good idea.
Right. And they copied a whole bunch of things that I'm sure were not actually adaptive or not particularly helpful.
Exactly.
Right. And that's, I mean, that's the real promise. I mean, the real potential now is that, you know, it's by really sort of blending, you know, empiricism, the ability to really sort of figure out what are the parts that are actually helpful and what are the parts that aren't. But then, I mean, the second stage, you know, I mean, I think science has done a great job of that in the last few hundred years, but have really failed in the second stage of then understanding how do ideas actually move. Okay, we figured out that, you know, in order to do well at school, you have to, like, look at your mistakes, analyze them, embrace them, whatever it may be. But then how do you really get that idea to move through the population? And that's where right. LeBron James comes in.
Right. And how do you get people to believe in the value of education or mm-hmm. to read to their children or all those things that would promote a bunch of those other abilities further down.
Right. And, you know, I mean, Pepsi has done an amazing job of that second part and total ignorance of, you know, and totally not paying attention to the first part.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think the book is fascinating, but it's also, I mean, I just think it's really, you know, this book and, you know, Why Nations Fail and a whole bunch of other books that are sort of giving us a much more accurate view of how human beings actually work and how we think. It's just a really, I think it's an exciting time because we've sort of run up against this wall of having all this great science that then doesn't get applied. And, you know, people like you and Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson and, you know, Daniel Kahneman's work on heuristics and Jonathan Haidt's work on the righteous mind, you know, you're really now putting together a model for how we can get science to move into the and become culture.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's really driving this kind of recent explosion in all these different areas is the breaking down of disciplinary borders. So, you know, working in economics, drawing insights from psychology, and kind of putting it all together into an evolutionary framework, I think is having the kind of collective brain effect, the recombination of different ideas that really drives cumulative cultural knowledge forward.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, right? Because, I mean, you know, that's one of the huge concepts. That's chapter 12 in your book, right? Our collective brains. And, you know, the real barrier to ideas moving between groups is essentially tribalism, right? And there's been a lot of that in academia.
Right. So, you know, you get socialized into whether you're a sociologist or an anthropologist. You get told what kind of methods you are. You get told what the standards of evidence are. And I've been fortunate to be able to be a professor of anthropology and of psychology and of economics. And it's just amazing to see the differences in what counts as high quality work in those three disciplines.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there's a real judgment. I mean, I won't name names, but a friend of mine is a neuroscientist, and you know, she just talks about. I mean, she's a neuroscientist with a math background and all this sort of stuff, and you know, she talks to you know some people, and they're like, "Oh, you're a mathematician. What are you doing this?" And you know, "Oh, you're a neuroscientist. What are you?" And back and forth, right? And I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean,
right. You know, yeah, and there's a real suspicion if you don't have a PhD in the particular discipline that you're trying to make a contribution to.
Right. And I mean, you know, obviously everything that we know about innovation and, you know, what your book really reinforces is that it's cross-pollination.
Right.
And so that we want people who are more interdisciplinary, who are changing fields, who are going back and forth between different things.
Yeah. So you've got to actively, if you want to generate innovation, you've got to actively fight against the tendency to tribalize.
Right.
And to, you know, to close borders between different groups of people that are focusing on different kinds of problems in different ways.
And that's one of the things that we have to fight, right? I mean, is basically to, you know, change the norm around tribalism, right? I mean, currently tribalism is still a good thing, but now it should be a shameful thing. It should almost be like, why haven't you changed disciplines?
Right. Right. Why aren't you walking across borders and collaborating broadly?
Right.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, again and again and again, you know, you go through this book and it's just, I mean, it really does. I haven't been this excited about this book, a book probably since Guns, Germs, and Steel, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, that's great to hear. That book has been a real inspiration to me.
Yeah. I mean, I read it right before my freshman year of college. And I mean, it was just like, wow, a book can do this. It can so utterly change your view of the world and inspire you. And that's really what this book does, The Secret of Our Success, How Culture is Driving Human Evolution, Domesticating Our Species, and Making Us Smarter. If you like to sound smart at parties, I would really recommend getting this book, reading it, and memorizing every anecdote. It's really just a fantastic book. I mean, you should be very, very proud of it.
Thanks a lot, Hunter.
As always, you know, all of this information will be in the write-up, you know, various ways to, you know, follow, the Professor Joseph Henrich, and then, where you can get the book on Amazon and everywhere else. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Yep. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Brian Callen Show. Without God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, Brian Callen, the man himself. But know that he is everywhere and all-powerful. I'm sure that that's what he would want me to say. So, Brian loves you, and he has sent me to prepare the way for his return at some point. So, yeah, I think I'm John the Baptist. That's my role. All right. Talk to you guys soon. Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.